Okay, well, hi, everyone. I'm Josh Schlossberg with Energy Justice Network, as you know. Thanks for making it on this month's National Anti-Biomass Incineration Campaign call. We have calls on the first Thursday of every month at varying times where we focus on a particular topic relevant to biomass energy, invite guest speakers, and discuss the issue. This month's topic is a pediatrician's perspective on air pollution in children. For the next hour, we'll discuss the human health impacts of biomass incineration and other forms of industrial air pollution with a focus on our nation's most vulnerable population, our children. Our guest speaker is Dr. Norma Krilein, medical doctor and fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Krilein is a practicing pediatrician in Indiana who has been fighting against biomass incineration based on her experience treating children suffering from illnesses related to air pollution and other things. In September 2012, Dr. Krilein, two other medical doctors, and a scientist presented at the first ever congressional briefing in Washington, D.C. on the health impacts of biomass incineration. Dr. Krilein will speak for about 15 minutes, or pretty much as long as she wants, and then we'll have the remaining time for questions, so please hold your questions until then. And again, we are recording this call so we can pass around the audio to folks who are inside the network and outside of it. Samantha Chirillo with Energy Justice Network will be taking notes, which we'll also send out to the listserv. We have everyone so far who's been on the call. And Dr. Krilein, go ahead and take it away.
Thank you. If you have a PowerPoint in front of you, if you don't, it's on saveamericasforest.org. My background is basically as a pediatrician. I did my undergraduate at Notre Dame, my graduate school at Indiana University, and my residency at Los Angeles County, which is a very busy kind of hands-on place. I've been in private practice in Southern Indiana since July of 89, so right at 24 years. And one of the things about staying in one place is you really start to see, you know, patterns of number one, what happens to bodies over time. Number two, you know, the limitations and successes that you have in medicine. And it really is an unbelievable privilege to have such a longitudinal study of data input that colors, you know, what you do with children, what works. You know, if you have to actually sit there and see whether or not a medication or a treatment works or how children are over time, it's different from not having that feedback. Now, that being said, the Ohio River area has always been a quagmire of allergies and asthma. It's kind of one of those frequently known facts. It's called Ohio River fever. It goes by several different monikers, and I had always kind of wondered why is it that way, because it's a relatively rural area, and never really thought of it as a hotbed of industry. I basically spent my career seeing patients. I also had a pretty big role in leadership in the hospital, and had always kind of thought, why is this the case? When I became involved in biomass, actually at the request of Rock Emmert, who's on this call, who asked me to look at some of the things going on because our town was interested in retrofitting a coal-based power plant to burn biomass, and I mistakenly assumed that our town leaders would do the right thing and were on the somewhat, at least partly, the same agenda I was. Only to find out that life as I knew it was going to change pretty quickly, because it turned out I was not even close to being aware of how completely unmonitored and illicit air pollution was in the general Southern Indiana area. And things began to fall into place with what I knew about medicine and what I had learned over time, especially over the past 5 to 10 years, with the unbelievable amount of medical studies that have taken place that equate inflammation with disease. Now, being in medicine, I may digress a little bit and try to explain a few things for you. For example, like a medical diagnosis is kind of like a 911 address, and the reason we speak in medical diagnoses is to try to be specific. On the other hand, not all medical diagnoses are specific, and they don't necessarily, they mean something specific, but they don't necessarily give you the reason. So, for example, in the past 5 to 10 years, there's been a ton of research done on the fact that, for example, the process that leads to a heart attack is an inflammatory process. The process that leads to cancer is frequently an inflammatory process. And, you know, being someone that has always tried to keep up on continuing education, pediatric board certification requires you to completely recertify every 7 years. So I've always tried to attend conferences and stay up to date on things. And so that whole notion of inflammation sort of kind of wearing and tearing at the body, and then to find out that there's a lot more pollution than what I thought, was like this huge light bulb that went off in my head to explain the undertow as to why I was seeing a lot of what I was seeing. And that was led to my involvement in opposing this plant and becoming more involved in air pollution advocacy in general. So this talk was about biomass. Ironically, the biomass plant we were opposing is not even built yet. Most of what is going on where I live to date is coal-based industry. Jasper has a lot of wood furniture plants, so there's a lot of aromatic compounds, lacquers, and that type of thing floating around in the air. The picture that I took when I basically started fighting this plant, the city more or less decided and made my life a living hell, and I decided that because of the practice, in order to have a healthy existence, I moved my practice 28 miles east of here, east of Jasper, and ironically started commuting past one of the bigger coal plants in the area, and that's what the slide is there that says severe visible air pollution where I live and work. That cloud is the Petersburg coal plant. Now, just to give you an example of things are not always what they seem, Indiana claims to meet national air quality standards. I drive past this, see this big cloud, and think my patients are soaking in this all night long. I don't see how this can possibly meet federal air quality standards. But again, here's another scientific issue. It all depends on your data. Your reasoning is only as good as your data. And the nearest monitor to this plant is literally 20 miles east in Jasper, Indiana. So governments frequently manipulate data to where they kind of feign that they are complying, when in fact they really are not providing a safe environment, because they conveniently place monitors to prove what they want to prove. There's also quite a bit of special interest science involved, and that's kind of become one of our passions and issues, is to try to recognize what is really good data. I've always, by virtue of my Hippocratic Oath, tried to stay with medical science, and I hope you'll notice that that is the case. Whereas most of the time when you're talking about, at least unfortunately, our state environmental officials and or the biomass industries, marketing campaigns, that there is a huge mathematical shift. Now, I'm a very, very mathematical person, and I like things to kind of stay in one place so that you can, again, that's the medical background, and the mathematical background is, let's define something and stick with it so that we know exactly what we're talking about. If I write down that a kid's 3 years old and then they suddenly become 5 years old and then they become 1 year old, that wouldn't make any sense. But that's a similar argument that I would advise you to look at whenever something sounds too good to be true or it seems to be moving around. There's generally a manipulation of data or poor measurement of data. And I know that's definitely the case in how our state measures air pollution, is they say they comply with EPA guidelines, but if a monitor is 20 miles away from this cloud of smoke, there's no way that that monitor is compliant can say that the people living in this are going to be very healthy. The next picture, where more pollution equals more patients, that baby basically came in about three or four weeks before the congressional briefing. And the little baby laying there that doesn't look very good, she has a congenital heart defect. And her color is not very good. Her older sister was coughing. And basically, here's the typical scenario that I'm in. These kids come in, they're coughing, they're wheezing, and you can either give them oral steroids that make them wound up, bug-eyed, not sleeping, and aggressive, or you can try to treat them with inhaled steroids in a nebulizer to cool off the inflammation of what's going on, but that comes at a price, where a box of Pulmicort, which is a safe, low-dose inhaled steroid to give to a baby because you have to administer it in a nebulizer to get it into their lungs, costs about $200. That's a minimum. Now, this family is a Mennonite family, and that's $200 out of pocket. The strep throat the older child had only cost $5 to treat. So be very aware also that when you have health impacts of biomass and other pollutants, doctors are not cheap and drugs are not cheap. And they can absolutely escalate depending upon what is going on. The American Lung Association, as you know, opposes it. There's good reason for that. But kind of to get into the meat of why I feel the way I do about pollution, the next slide on biomass, incineration, and air pollution. Air pollution triggers inflammation. Inflammation is a primary immune response in the body. You can't turn it off. It is responsible for disease. It is disease. Basically, the inflammatory response is not the response of your immune system getting you over something. It's the grouchy part of your immune system. It's the part that produces a lot of mucus, that produces a lot of swelling. It damages tissues over time. It is inherently wired in, but it's part of the immune system. Therefore, if you try to turn it off, number one, it's very difficult to turn it off. But number two, if you turn it off, you turn off the rest of the immune system. So I don't know if you noticed watching a lot of the commercials that you see on television about the biological drugs they use for rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease. They advertise those a lot. What's the major thing they say? It impairs your immune system. It can lead to tuberculosis. It can lead to lymphoma. There is a cost to be paid if you try to knock out that inflammatory response. So disease from air pollution is very difficult to treat because treating inflammation is expensive. And children who are sick, like that pair that I just saw, often miss school. Parents miss work to care for them. And even in this family where that child is still at home, the medical cost is outrageous. On the next slide, inflammation is a disease process. It is a primary immune response to a trigger. It is a disease, becomes an ongoing disease when the trigger, air pollution, doesn't go away. you can see an inflammatory response, for example, from influenza. The virus, the flu virus, the real flu virus, is an extremely inflammatory virus that's actually tracked to some of the same processes that air pollution is, because it triggers the inflammatory response. And the thing to understand about the inflammatory response is that it is a cascade, not a tightly regulated feedback loop. Now, what I mean by that medically is, for example, if you, and I tell teenagers this, for example, if you wanted to run and you wanted to try to run 55 miles an hour, your body would tell you pretty quickly that you're not the bionic man and your heart rate only goes up as high as what the oxygen can feed it. It's going to stop. It's not going to continue to go up and up and up. It's going to stop at a certain level. That's a regulated feedback loop in the body that limits how fast you can run. Well, there are other things like the inflammatory response that will continue like a domino effect to operate without any negative feedback loop whatsoever. And so the inflammatory process, once it is initiated, will continue until the trigger is taken away. So if you have something like influenza, where your immune system makes antibodies to the virus and the virus eventually stops being produced, then yes, you're going to have an inflammatory response to influenza, and you may have a heart attack from that, but ultimately the virus goes away. Other viruses like AIDS, hepatitis C, other viruses that are chronic can potentially sustain a long-term inflammatory response and produce, you know, a eventual damage to organs in much the same way that air pollution is, because if the body cannot turn off the replication, then the inflammation continues. Does that make sense? Because if you have an ongoing trigger, then it's like gas on the fire. And so your inflammatory response will continue frequently indefinitely. Now, to some extent, there is variation between bodies. Some people's bodies are far more grouchy than others. Some people fight infection with very little inflammatory response, and some people don't fight infection and have a huge inflammatory response. Those are going to be the ones that get into particular trouble. Those are your basic allergic, asthmatic people. They don't ever kill anything in their body. They basically eventually tell their body to kill itself. And we work hard to try to unglue that, but it basically becomes where you can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. So the next slide, air pollution causes disease by triggering inflammation. Particulate pollution and many other forms of pollution are very potent inflammatory triggers. Now, both acute and chronic inflammation cause damage. Acute inflammation would be something, for example, caused by a virus where the virus eventually gets knocked out. But they play critical roles in many disease processes by stimulating clot and scar formation. So they essentially damage the body over time and accelerate the aging process. And disease risk and damage are dose-related to pollutant levels, and they are worsened or become irreversible with severe acute or chronic ongoing exposure, and also, like I said, depending upon the genetic makeup of the person that you're talking about. So the next slide, how a pollutant becomes a chronic disease. The lung is generally the recipient. You can also get penetration of other barriers, but the lung basically gets these pollutants into the systemic circulation, where the body the immune system sees these compounds, recruits and activates inflammatory cells, and that then is becomes your chronic disease process, which can have one of many names. This is why, because inflammation is such a general process, you see so many different things, and you'll see that at the end of this talk, how many different diseases can be triggered by air pollution, because basically anything that has an inflammatory pathway, which is a lot of stuff, is going to be dose-related to air pollution or increase if you have air pollution. And here, and that's the big list there, autoimmunity. Autoimmunity is type 1 diabetes, lupus, those are the big two there. Neurodegeneration, the brain is capable of an inflammatory response. So neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's are going to track with air pollution. Metabolic diseases, I think they're mainly hinting at type 2 diabetes there, but cardiovascular diseases, because of the role that inflammation has in triggering clotting, cardiovascular diseases like heart attacks and strokes are going to track with air pollution. Cancer is also going to track with air pollution because inflammation wears down the body over time, and I've got some slides on that coming up. And basically aging, the body wears out from all this wear and tear. It doesn't necessarily repair the damage of chronic inflammation. And then some special pediatric considerations. Kids spend more time outside and breathe in more air pollutants per pound of body weight. Their barriers are less effective, plus potentially they are exposed to it over a long period of time and their bodies are still building. Their brain isn't done yet. Their lungs aren't done yet. And just like building a house where if you build a house with bad nails, you cannot necessarily go back in and nail it together and have the same house. This is what happens to children when they have ongoing environmental exposure. You may get something like an inflammatory response in the brain, and it presents itself as attention deficit disorder, or it may present itself as autism. Autism, I can promise you from seeing this, the potential impact, my observation is that the potential impact of pollutants is far greater than the potential impact of immunizations will ever be in the pathophysiology of autism. And why? Well, look at your ongoing exposure. How many tons of these pollutants are put out by, well, especially factories and power plants in our area, compared to the micro amount that a child sees in a vaccine? It's not proliferating even like a natural disease. Not that it can't be pointed to as a potential problem, but I definitely think, especially when you look at how much pollutants are underreported, that, and I've never seen, for example, all these processes track with giving vaccines the way they track to air pollution. So a child's cumulative lifetime exposure affects their developing body and absolutely affects their family and future and what they're going to be capable of doing. If you look in the article citations, California did some unbelievably revealing studies where children had lung scarring of up to 20% from living nearby freeways. And that's permanent. That's basically, it doesn't ever get any bigger than that. It limits literally what their lungs can do for the rest of their life. So acute versus chronic diseases. Modern medicine, you can cut about anything back together again and put it back together again. You know, what we can do from a surgical standpoint is unbelievable. But if you look, I mean, if you really look, especially at the expense that's involved versus the side effects and the downside, medicine is not very effective at curing chronic diseases. Very effective at trauma, very effective at bacterial infections, and actually very effective at preventing diseases with vaccines and public health initiatives like, well, actually it would be nice if pollution control were the same public health initiative that sewage control was. Ironically, we don't see it that way, and I think we need to look at it more that way with the type of damage that can occur. But only in the past 20 years are we beginning to understand the role that inflammation plays in chronic disease and how much pollution is the trigger. And chronic diseases are extremely progressive, expensive, and devastating. Now, look, for example, the next slide. I don't know how many of you saw the cilia video already, but this is basically the progression of airway disease. You're inhaling pollutants causes the lining of the lungs to swell and produce more mucus. So instead of breathing through a large airway, the muscles around the airway constrict, and then you also get swelling and more mucus, further limiting airflow and clearance. So you're breathing through an extremely small area. If you go to the next slide, over time, that causes damage and scarring and in the long run. And then also in the short run, pollutants damage the cilia. That video that was there where you saw literally the particles moving out of the lung almost like a moving sidewalk, if you expose those cilia to smoke, and I remember seeing this video one time, it basically, they swim in a circle because the cilia do not beat effectively and or the cilia look like a tornado hit. Now, it doesn't take much to imagine that just right there, how much more likely you're going to be to acquire a virus if it's not carried back out of the body, plus how much more limited you're going to be in your airflow and ability to get oxygen into the tissues if you have this ongoing inflammation. And the other problem is you really can't see. I can tell you as a physician, it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to look at a patient and try to imagine, you know, I saw basically 5 or 6 kids today that were coughing, but I can't for 1 minute begin to see the level of inflammation that's in their lungs the way I can, you know, potentially look at their skin and see if they have a rash. Now, this next slide on progression of airway disease, that Hagen-Poiseuille equation is huge. It's huge relative to the development of asthma. It's also huge, if you think about it, in the relationship of clots causing strokes. Whenever you decrease the flow of something, whether you're decreasing airflow, whether you're decreasing blood flow, if you decrease airflow or you decrease blood flow, you dramatically affect how the body operates. And especially in children, see, both their blood vessels and their airways are smaller. So any swelling or any restriction is going to be exponentially more significant because it's relative to the radius of your tube to the fourth power. So when you narrow airways, you quickly achieve in children significant obstruction. So what are the limits of asthma treatments? Just briefly, steroids are supposed to decrease the swelling in the mucus. Inhaled steroids are safer, but they're extremely expensive. The average box of Pulmicort that goes in the nebulizer costs $200 to $300. Your average inhaled steroid for a month now costs between $80 and $150 a month. And systemic steroids affect the whole body. So it's, as you can see on the next slide, it's an extremely vicious cycle. Families either can't afford the inhalers, and the inhalers do not necessarily fix the problem when the trigger is ongoing, and that doesn't even begin to touch the areas that you can't reach, like the brain and the bloodstream. You know, this is just talking about the narrowing that you see in the lung. It does not begin to touch what inflammation does to brain and the thought process, and it does not touch what it does chronically to the circulatory system. That next slide was where I had the cilia video initially. So this is what normal cilia looks like at a cross-section. And then the next slide, as you can see, is what sulfur dioxide does to cilia. It literally melts them together. Now, one basic pearl of medicine I can tell you, the cilia melted together cannot move mucus, which produces stagnation. Stagnation breeds infection. The body has to keep moving. You don't get that snot out of the sinuses. You don't get that snot out of the lungs. You will grow bacteria, which is sinus infection, pneumonia, and bronchitis. And then here's another vicious cycle. Bacteria are inflammatory. They are inherently polluting. So when you breathe the pollutants in and you get more mucus, then you get more bacteria, which in and of itself increases the polluting level of the body. And then you get more particulate absorption. The bacteria and viruses are more likely to invade and reproduce, which then produce even more inflammation and less airflow, and that adds insult to injury when you see that heart baby that I talked about earlier. And to talk about another effect, pollution has an effect on the placenta as a circulatory organ and on the development of the fetus. You will see many, many more developmental anomalies like the tetralogy of flow that baby had when you have exposure to environmental toxins, especially in our area where you get a cocktail of farming pollution from atrazine, pesticides, and herbicides combined with the offfall from the coal power plants. And you will obviously see potential chromosomal damage and embryological damage that does not undo itself over time. So if you look at what that does to the cilia alone, the previous picture melts them together. Over time, they get destroyed and make more mucus cells instead of the cilia. So what's that going to do to your lung function? Instead of being able to bring the garbage out, you've got more mucus inside the lung, replacing the cilia. And then eventually you get what's called squamous metaplasia, which is end-stage early cancer formation. And the end result is similar to if you smoke over time, that's the progression that I just gave you, you eventually end up with cancer. So here's another patient to show you kind of how these things literally kind of domino. This boy...
Hey, Norma, yeah. Do you want to take another 5 minutes and then we'll open it up to questions for the last 15? Will that work for you?
That'd be okay. I mean, it's almost done.
Perfect.
But a lot of patients have things like this guy where he lives in a polluted community, has always had allergies and asthma, and then develops type 1 diabetes on top of it. So he can't have any steroids. Everything is infinitely worse because of the diabetes and the amount of cost that a patient like him has and yet is exorbitant, and yet he has no choice over the fact that he lives in one of the most polluted areas in the country. His school was in the top 5% in the 2008 USA Today article on in the year that he developed his diabetes. How pollutants damage the brain, that might be, it's about two or three slides further. This one is particularly relative to biomass, because biomass is a particular producer of what are called ultrafine particulates. Your coarse particulates, PM2.5 to PM10, those are the kind that come back out from the cilia. They're inhaled, but they're coarse enough that they're literally carried back out again. Your brain becomes the nose for ultrafines, and ultrafine particulates can be inhaled directly from the nose into the bloodstream and carried straight into the brain along with heavy metals. So ultrafine particulates from biomass are, I think, if it's actually looked at, way more likely to impact upon autism and attention deficit disorder than anything, just because of that particular route straight into the brain, where you're bypassing any filtering process that the body can give you and triggering inflammation directly into the brain. And that chronic inflammation, it's got a list there. It's kind of technical, but you notice the bottom line, the bottom one says DNA damage. When you start doing those type of things, or the blood-brain barrier damage, the amount of things that you can see as a result of that are all going to be extremely devastating. So those ultrafines can be directly absorbed into the brain or potentially carried there from the lung. The next slide shows the quagmire that we live in and why I got involved. Literally 26% of children in some of the counties surrounding Evansville, 26% qualify for special education services, and that air pollution increases the incidence of learning disabilities. Several of those studies are cited in my list. And then the last slide, basically, it should be no big surprise from what I just was explaining. The domino effect in the body of all the things that result from inflammation and cell damage is going to be just about every disease process that you could talk about. And it's generally going to be dose-related. It's going to hit some people harder than others, but it's mathematically inevitable simply because you trigger processes that have no feedback loop and exponentially worsen over time. And that's
excellent.
More or less the end of it.
Excellent. Thank you, Norma. Just really quick before we go on to the Q&A, can we just have the folks who came on in the middle of the call just very briefly state their names and their state so we can have that for the notes, please?
Mike Ewall, Energy Justice, DC.
Laura Norkish Crampton, registered nurse, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Could you repeat that one more time? Sorry.
I'll try to. She's supposed to put it up.
Jim Travers.
And do we have a couple other people? According to my little thing here, it says there's a few more people on. Okay, that's fine. Could those who want to ask questions, just say your names right now. I'll jot you down, and then we'll go ahead and do that. So anyone who have questions, just tell me your name right now.
This is Laura calling from Minneapolis, and I was curious. Can I ask?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I read another, there was another study that talked about lower test scores and in schools and near incinerators and lower academic performance. Now, I've never really thought about the special ed statistic. Are those statistics easy to come by? Because it seems like that would really sound some alarms for surrounding communities to see some real impacts, you know, of what industrial sources of pollution could be doing to their children.
In Indiana, believe it or not, those are straight off the Department of Education website.
Wow.
Unfortunately, screaming about them has done absolutely nothing. It's you can ask Rock. It is just, to me, that is a public health emergency like none other. And yet I can't seem to get anyone concerned about either the cost or the long-term devastation that those type of statistics mean.
Is there a racial disparity regarding, since the location of these facilities so often are near, you know, underserved communities?
Well, possibly, because I think a lot of those communities, at least in southern Indiana, they're still predominantly white, in southern Indiana anyway, and there's this notion that we have to have jobs even if those jobs kill us, and even if they're some of the worst pollution to employment ratio polluters that there are, these companies still, well, these counties, actually that Posey County with the 26%, Rock will verify this, they just voted to add a fertilizer plant into the mix and spend several billion dollars on it to produce, what is it, Rock, less than 20 new jobs?
It's minimal. I can't remember the exact number.
Yes. They literally just, because nobody connects the two. I mean, I live three counties away. I've talked to our central environmental management is, I don't have a good word to describe it, but their response to me was, some things just don't make any sense, because if this were from air pollution, the statistics should be going down because our air quality has improved over the past 15 years. So they basically quote conclusions that are based upon faulty data to kind of reassure us that this really isn't happening. So it's kind of this spin where, you know, it just goes right back to where it was before. It should be a wake-up call, but at least in our area, it's unbelievable the degree to which you can't even shake people into being upset about it.
Wow. Thank you.
I would strongly suggest trying it, but it's going to depend upon, I think, the culture in which you live.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But the state education website is a good place to look, because most of those statistics, believe it or not, are actually public.
Okay,
and if Indiana lists them on their Department of Education website, I can't believe that other states don't.
Thank you.
If I could interject here, this is Rock Emmert. I live near Norma here in DuBois County area. Minimally, we need to have more monitors, like the report that the biomass energy project just sent out this week, a site out in Washington State that's planning to place monitors, and I understand these are government-funded monitors, downwind from a lot of the plants that are suspicious or likely to be causing issues. Here, we're talking about correlational statistics. This Posey County statistic, 20-some percent, is very close to some of the nation's most polluting power plants. So we're trying to get more monitors in those areas to possibly start a dialogue and get people to wake up and there aren't enough causational studies between these plants and the health effects, but there are many anecdotal, a lot of anecdotal evidence and a lot of statistical evidence that at least raises many alarms where somebody should be asking more questions and doing more studies.
I see the solution potentially in what I saw a couple years ago in terms of satellite technology tracking particulates, because Indiana, for example, I can tell you systemically is entrenched in not monitoring. You know, there's 40 and 50 miles between monitors where a lot of these power plants are, but they actually were able to do what I thought was a landmark study a couple of years ago. I think I might have it listed in the it's under reproduction in my citations. Using new satellite-based exposure methods to study the association between pregnancy 2.5 exposure, premature birth, and birth weight in Massachusetts, where basically you take it out of the state's hands and you use satellite technology to monitor some of the particulates, and that can be tracked in much more real time to some of the consequences, whereas I think some of the states and counties and cities that are the most blind to this literally choose not to measure. And so it's a double bind where your hands are tied because, you know, for example, I see the connection, but I don't have the ability to put a monitor to prove what I'm seeing. And then they will claim it comes from somewhere else besides them.
Your comment about sewage, Norma, I thought was really pertinent because when you think about our water supply and how far it's come over the course of the past 50 years, and granted it's still far from ideal in a lot of communities, but we're years away from having the same sort of awareness of what's in our air.
Well, the bad news is ultimately the ultra-fine stuff that's in the air will potentially also be in the water, and it's not filterable the way the bacteria and stuff are. So it's going to come around and be a problem because air and water, ultimately, they share the same environment. And, you know, where mercury and metals are concerned, one will affect the other, and the air will eventually filter into the soil and the water.
Question from Larry Edwards.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, you were just mentioning, Norma, satellite monitoring of particulate matter. I was just wondering, is that able to distinguish these different size classes, and particularly the ultrafine or other small ones?
I have no idea what that technology is. That was just one study I saw where, boy, this would be a way for them to study it that JASPER couldn't negate the significance if it was basically up in the sky. That was specifically about 2.5. I don't know what the status of that is, to be honest with you, other than it's in the cooker and probably will be bought out by a power plant company and sludge somewhere.
Well, this is Chris Zinder from Lakeview. I've got a couple questions. The first one is how is the public health agencies, how are they involved with the process? Are they on board with the same ideals that you are?
No. Public health tends to be measles, sexually transmitted diseases, sewage, and other things, and environment is shuttled out, at least in Indiana, to a completely different, completely unresponsive agency. Now, I wrote just in the past few months to public health officials specifically about some of these special ed rates, and they acted like even though this has been in the cooker for a while, they agreed this was a public health problem, but I have not gotten a response as of yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, no, you compartmentalize it to where If you're the governor of Indiana, you make sure that the environment takes care of the environment and public health is defined as something else. You just change the job description.
My second question is somewhat related in that, is there a national effort of people like yourself that are willing to respond to individual air containment discharge permits that are offered for each of these facilities, no matter the state they're in? I can tell you here in Lakeview, Oregon, we've got some of the worst PM2.5 emissions in the country, and we're 100 miles from nowhere. And it's primarily from wood stoves and such. But that said, no public health official, no health official whatsoever has shown any interest in commenting to our permitting processes without being provided a fee. And so I'm wondering whether or not there is any national effort or state efforts to help individual groups who are opposing biomass facilities prepare comments to these permitting actions.
Well, that would be helpful. To give you an example of what happened to the coal permit for the power plant here that they're going to convert, it was approved by IDEM in spite of the fact that it's not working anymore and had a fire last year, and then because of budget cuts, was approved by the EPA without even being read. We actually currently have a one of our members of our group put in a 47-page article, commentary directly to the administrator of the EPA, which should be back in the next few weeks, objecting to it. But basically, that is environmental management as we know it in Indiana. There's no accountability. It's basically, you know, whereas up until the last 10 to 15 years, there was so much, it appeared to be so much progress made through the Clean Air Act. But in the last 15 years, the amount of takeover by industry and the degree to which that has affected what the EPA considers as guidelines, and then each individual state is responsible for enforcement, and there's very little, actually that's the thing our state officials hide behind, is there's no consistent ranking of state environmental enforcement, so they basically get to claim that they're compliant.
Well, yes, as we found here in Oregon, it seems as though the EPA is willing to defer all clean air and clean water kind of issues to the states and then wash their hands of it from there. Which, again, you know, being involved in the development of the rules that govern these permitting processes is very important. And I think that the medical profession has a large role to play insofar as they have much greater stature than just, say, somebody like myself who just lives in the, you know, lives here and is opposing such a thing. So, anyway,
well,
thank you.
I could not agree with you more. But I can tell you I'm in the distinct minority in terms of playing an advocacy role there, because most medical officials are either not aware of the connection because they've not been in a place long enough. They're too into just the treatment and the overall medical research that is more about what to do for it and how much money you make on that, and not the fact that literally, you see so many more of these kids, and I asked one of our special ed people about 4 or 5 months ago, and she said, just to give you the kind of statistics in the community I live in, the severely affected special ed children have increased by 300% over the past 15 years. That cannot be accounted for on vaccines, not with what I see medically. 300% of the kids that they basically have to do full care and push around in wheelchairs, et cetera. And see, even the prematures you can account for on pollution because of the effect that the pollution has on the placenta.
You got to get the school board involved. The cost of all this needs to be put in front of them.
I could not agree more, but I tell you what, I've always been treated like I'm a lone crazed pediatrician in terms of, you know, the parents around here don't seem to get it. I can't look at these kids and not be upset, but there's such inertia, at least in this area, and such isolation. Rock will vouch for this. It's unbelievable. They just, I guess, expect the schools to fix it or medicine to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, and I can promise you it's not happening.
This is Rock again. My cousin was hired by one of the local Southern Indiana small-town newspapers, and he was told upon his being hired that he can write feature stories about any subject he wanted, but don't you dare talk about the smokestacks across the Ohio River. This was in Telt City, Indiana, Perry County, the county just south of us. That was part of his job criteria, that he could not address pollution because of all those jobs, and don't even go there, is what he was told, to give you some idea of how pervasive it is in the culture. And the same has been true of our local media here in DuBois County.
Yeah. This is Mercedes. I have a question. Would you please give the website again where we can see your PowerPoint? And also, was there a video that you were referencing? And how do I get that video?
The website is www.saveamericasforests.org. And I think if you get your website to Josh, the video is, I can, Mercedes, I got your email. I'll send it to you.
Well, I'm going to be sending out an email with the recording of this call with the notes, and I will include that as well. I had sent that previously to the biomass opponents listserv, but I will get that out there. Again,
okay.
For sure.
Thanks.
Norma, you were saying that the parents just don't get it, and I'm just curious how the parents are getting whatever information they're getting. Are you speaking of ones that you've been treating their children, or are you just talking about parents at large in the community?
Mainly parents at large in the community, because of, and this has kind of been something that I think industry has accomplished over the past 10 to 15 years. It's been extremely effective, and that is the poison carrot of no job, no America, that we cannot see America as a less polluted but more labor-intensive area. You know, sadly, the direction this is all going is more toxic and less jobs and more expensive, but most families, at least as they would advocate in public and the way that most people who work for corporations are caught into this. I saw this in the hospital I work for, where people will, these are hospital workers, because the hospital chose this as politics instead, seriously. My local hospital that I was employed at chose this biomass plant as a neutral thing because it's politics, not healthcare. And they specifically told everybody in hospital administration that this is the buzzword. So, you know, some of it you're fighting an industrial undertow that effectively silences opposition out of fear. And that fear is, if you speak up, you're going to lose your job. Or if you speak up, there's going to be less jobs for your family and things will be even worse than what they are. And I've seen that politically the past 5 to 10 years. And it's sad that we can't think of ourselves as more ingenious and entrepreneurial, that we have to basically rely on polluting our children to this degree to get ahead in America.
I'm wondering about ways to get some more national coverage of it, where you get away from the local politics, like maybe ProPublica, which does investigative journalism and seems to do a pretty good job of it, or maybe Frontline on PBS. There's probably other avenues as well.
We've contacted a lot of those already and not had any biters. I've contacted Bill Denman of NBC. I've contacted 60 Minutes. I've contacted the Wall Street Journal. Rock will back me up on this. We have pleaded and sent those statistics, and it just doesn't seem to be a priority. Sometimes you get the, gee, there's so much corruption we can't even start, versus the total dead response where, you know, they're fearing, I think, the same thing, that somebody's going to have their tail if they start reporting it. But I couldn't agree with you more, but I have not been able to get anybody to bite nationally on how significant this is.
We just got to keep hammering away at them, and hopefully it's not coming down to the issue of once they build more and more facilities, then they'll find out once it's too late. Hopefully we can practice good medicine and be preventative. But I think if enough folks do continue to speak out in this way, especially courageous medical doctors such as Norma here, I think it will eventually make them have to listen.
Believe it or not, the Massachusetts Medical Society, this is one thing Rock presented to me 3 years ago that got me involved. 20,000 doctors in Massachusetts where they have a lot of biomass. Again, I suspect they were seeing the same thing I was seeing, voted categorically that biomass was a human health risk. You can't get 20,000 doctors to agree on much of anything. When I saw that, to be honest with you, that's all I needed to see. But the amount of head turning otherwise is unbelievable. I mean, that, I think it's just a matter of doctors aren't as much advocates as what they used to be. They're kind of stuck in their own little world of, you know, my practice might suffer. That's why I left the practice I was at, was I was literally told to shut up, that the business we had was going to suffer. And this was a practice that I founded 24 years ago.
Could I say something? This is Jim Travers.
Please.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go
yes.
for it.
First, thanks so much for your work and your reports. This is great stuff. I'm calling from the Albany, New York area, and my hometown's about 10 miles south of here, 12 miles south, and there's a cement plant there, and right across the street from the cement plant is our middle and high schools. And, it made national news not too long ago, a couple of years ago, about emitting 400 pounds of mercury a year. Now, so particulates, and I'm fighting biomass. I come from it from the RFD, refuse-derived fuels aspect, as opposed to woody biomass. But so there are some of those proposals coming on here. One of the things that I've paid very close attention to over the years is these fine particulates, 2.5 microns and smaller, for which there is known technology that can filter these. And the epidemiological studies are so scarce, it seems that sick children and sick people make good business, and don't interfere with that, as well as what you say is don't hurt our business by making us look bad. And the fear that those powerful companies, like where this Ravenna cement plant, it's a Lafarge cement plant, is... the main economic engine in a rural town of about 8,000 people. So one of the things that I wanted to add, too, is that it would be really a great thing if some people who are really talented with graphic art who could do an animation of a cubic meter of air and throw together the different particulates and see what really is in a cubic meter of air that we're breathing. Now, it would be different for more highly polluted places. But and everyone's familiar, I hope, with Denny Larson's The Backyard Bucket Brigade. We're doing backyard testing on particulates. Anyway, I'll listen more. Thank you.
You know, if that got on national television, even as an advertisement, it might start waking people up. And then the problem with ultrafines is it's not even relative to weight. It's relative to surface area. And there was something else about what you said. I just lost my train of thought.
But as you say, the brain-blood barrier, these things are so small, they can pass through the placental barriers of women. It's, you know, the other thing we have to look at is the economy, the economic impacts of these pollutants, as opposed to... pollution controls. It's a terrible thing that we're having this fight. I mean, we're suing the EPA right now with Earth Justice to try and you know, the EPA arbitrarily delayed these particulate emissions from cement kilns another year, just completely arbitrarily.
If the companies making the scrubbers had half of the political savvy of the ones making the pollutants, we'd have a different problem.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's what I think. I think, you know, just the Clean Air Act alone had something like a $40 to $1 payout on health care benefits. And yet, you know, our ex-governor, Mitch Daniels, has called it the Employment Prevention Agency. There is a lot of that out there that seems to make people think that the pollution police are our enemies. And they don't see this information, and it's really ridiculous. Also, and I didn't mention this, but it is huge. Many, many universities are now paid off to do this research on the part of industry, and many of them are large state universities. The University of Illinois, for example, has paid large amounts to research biomass. Purdue University, unbelievably, in partnership with both Monsanto, who was sponsoring the grass to go into our power plant, and also the Biomass Working Group in Indiana is essentially a subsidiary of Purdue University, and there's not a single thing on there about the public health effects, but there is a lecture on how to deal with hostile audiences.
This is Jim Travers again. One other thing that we could do, I think, is go after the EPA and say the regulations aren't stringent enough. I mean, their levels are too high to be called danger, because our regulators say, oh, we'll meet the EPA regs on everything. But, well, maybe the EPA regs need to be lowered a little bit to make.
Well, you won't get much disagreement from the EPA scientists on that. They've always felt that way. The problem is they get overridden. They've been overridden by the past three administrations, starting with the Bush administration and heading straight into Obama. You know, that's the problem with these industries, is they are bipartisan. They will pay off whoever sits in the presidency, and those EPA regs are unglued by the executive branch, from what I've seen and understood.
Yeah, I agree there, 100%.
So it's been a bit over an hour. I think it's probably time to conclude the call, unless anyone has any last-minute things to say.
Thank you.
So thanks again to our wonderful guest speaker. Oh, did somebody want to chime in real quick? Oh, I guess I just imagined that. So thanks again to our guest speaker, Dr. Norma Kreiline, a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to everyone else who made it on the call. And just really quickly, we have these National Anti-Biomass Campaign calls the first Thursdays of every month. The next call is October 3rd. We'll be discussing the role of wildfire in native forest ecosystems and how the biomass and logging industries are manipulating the fear of fire to get out the cut. And to get a notice of the calls, if you don't already, or get a link of the recording of this call in the notes, you can email me, Josh Schlossberg, at josh@energyjustice.net. If you're subscribed to the Biomass Opponents listserv, you'll already be getting this. So thanks again, Dr. Kreiline, and thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good night. Oh, for your good work.
Josh, are you still there?